Nasıl? Many of you, I'm sure, know of the one of the two principal disciples of the Buddha named, in Sanskrit, Shariputra. Shariputra. And he, from his youth, was a friend of the other person who became one of the two chief disciples of the Buddha, in Sanskrit, Malgayayana, or Moggallana, Moggallana Buddha, in Pali. So they were friends from childhood on, and at the same time, in their youth, they both developed just spontaneously emerged some very strong renunciation, and they decided to devote themselves to the pursuit of liberation. They followed a teacher, I think his name was Sanjaya, for some time, who was probably quite brilliant, but a skeptic, but a brilliant and a skeptic, but they just found it didn't go anywhere. I mean, being a skeptic, so what do you wind up being? A skeptic. And so after a while, they just got a disillusioned with that as well, and they decided, look, let's split up. They were good buddies, really a team. And let's split up. Because if we stay together, we can only cover, you know, half the ground. But you go your way, I go mine. And we both know what we want. We want liberation. So whichever of us finds liberation, finds an authentic teacher, really finds the truth, then we have a pact. You know, that we're going to let the other one know real quickly. But we're going to split up so we cover more ground. So they did. They went off as wandering ascetics, shramanas, they're called in Sanskrit. And India, contemplatively, was really a real civilization at that time. It was a contemplative civilization, not implying at all, of course, that the population was just filled with contemplatives, but the civilization of India 2,500 years ago was mature enough, wise enough, that just as a culture they recognized that if there were people, and at that time they were only men, this changed with the Buddha, but if there were people, men, who wanted to devote themselves utterly to the pursuit of truth, to liberation, then they deserve a free lunch. Lifetime stipend, you know? And so they did. So that was really an option. If you just wanted to devote yourself to liberation, pretty much you just didn't have to worry about, you know, will you starve to death? No, the society recognizes what you're doing. They respect it enough that they're going to give you a free meal. They're going to keep you going. You'll not have the lap of luxury, but they're going to make sure that you can continue doing what you're doing. That, to my mind, is a contemplatively civilized society. And right now, we're in a pre-contemplative era of modern civilization. We haven't quite gotten there yet. So they set off, and then in his various peregrinations, his wandering around India, looking for, you know, an authentic path, an authentic teacher, he was out walking, and he saw a monk, a fellow shramana, walking on alms. His name was Asaji. And Sariputra basically took one look at him. And it was just one of those intuitive things, that it was just by the way he walked, just his sheer presence as he walked on his alms round. Sariputra just intuitive, he's found something. He's got something real. So he went up to him. He accosted him, approached him, and said, "Friend, who is your teacher? What's your teaching? What are you doing? What's your practice?" And as I recall, Asaji said, "Well, I'm only new to the practice, so I really can't explain, but this much I can say." And then I'll give you the Sanskrit, and my Sanskrit pronunciation is terrible, but I'll give it just for the inference of it, because it's become really a tradition to pass it on from generation to generation. I recite it 3 times every morning, and I have for decades now. Ye dharma hetu prabhava hetum desham chayo nirodhava evam bahima shramane svaha. I mangled it. Ye dharma hetu prabhava hetum desham tathagato hyavatat desham chayo nirodha evam vadima shramane. Oh yeah, I'm not fluent in Sanskrit. Tibetan pretty good. But the meaning of it is quite simple. He said, of those phenomena that are causally created, the tathagata, the enlightened one, has shown their causes. And he has shown their cessation too. That is the teaching of the great sage. You want it again? It's pretty simple. Of those phenomena that arise, that are causally created, the Tathagata has shown their causes. And he has shown their cessation too. Thus are the teachings of the great sage. Asaji just shared this very simple verse, which I'll keep with the Sanskrit, with Shariputra. And Shariputra immediately realized nirvana and became a stream enter. That's why I said it twice. I wanted to give you 2 chances. I gave it in the Sanskrit. I gave it in English. I gave it in English twice. You want German? Ein bisschen auf Deutsch? Or peut-être auf Français? I can't do it, but I could try. But of course, Shariputra was enormously ripe. He was just like a fruit just ready to drop into your hand. And it did. Just that one verse, and the fruit dropped. And he became a stream ender, a direct realization of emptiness, of nirvana. And he knew he'd found something authentic. He'd found it. Was not yet an arhat, but he was a stream ender. So now he's absolutely in the flow to become an arhat. And of course, being the good friend that he was, he immediately sought out his old friend, Malgalyayanaputra. And he found him and said, "Hey chum, yedarame hetu prabhava. And Malgalyayana achieved stream entry." Then, of course, they knew where the teaching came from. This teaching, I mean, it's just causality, right? The cause of causally generated things and their cessation. That was it. It's all about causality. But then, of course, they said, okay, well, let's trace this teaching to its source. They sought out, and quite quickly, I'm sure, they found the Buddha. Within 1 week, Shariputra achieved arhatship. And I was quite curious. I just read this today. And he received it directly in response to teachings given to him by the Buddha. And the teachings the Buddha was giving that just triggered him to achieve liberation were teaching on the elements. The elements. It took him 1 week. And then Malgalyayana, being a little bit of a slowpoke, relative to Shariputra, it took him 2 weeks. And the teaching that triggered it for him was teachings on the nature of feelings, the second of the four applications of mindfulness. So as I commented earlier, you don't need to necessarily have insight in all four to gain arhatship. One will do, because if you achieve nirvana, you've achieved nirvana. You don't have to achieve it multiple times through different avenues. So I found that quite inspiring. And then I was reading just the rest of his life, and he was, Shariputra, such a noble soul. Just noble soul. I mean, then you really see, this word noble one for arhat, for arya, it really has the right feel to it. He was really a noble soul. Compassionate, kind, caring, wise, skillful means. It was said that sometimes when the Buddha would be teaching, he'd get a little bit tired. And he's like, you know. And when he'd get a little bit tired, then he would turn over to Shariputra. Shariputra, take over for me. And then Shariputra would take over. You know? Quite extraordinary. So the causes of causally originated things and their cessation. It pertains directly to our meditation for this afternoon. As we continue to closely apply mindfulness to the mind. And what I'd like to do, I'm going to give a short preface. We'll go into it, then we'll have more time for discussion. I'd like to bring the awareness right into awareness itself. And then allowing, not suppressing, not cutting off, but allowing subjective impulses, mental factors, thoughts, or impulses, desires, emotions, and so forth, allowing them to arise. And then as they arise, see if you can identify that from which they arise. And then whatever subjective impulse, again, these are called semjung, that which emerges from sem, that which emerges from mind, and what kind of mind? Principle mind. Which principle mind? Mental consciousness. So those mental factors that are arising, or mental processes that are arising from the primary continuum of mental consciousness, observe what they're arising from. See if you can be right there, just observing their genesis, and observe where they're coming from. And then they flower, they come out, they manifest, but then, of course, they vanish. Observe what they vanish into. So of these causally generated things, observe the cause. And as they cease, observe how they cease, and observe that into which they cease. So that's for these subjective impulses, the semjung, the emergences from sem, or they're called mental factors or mental processes. Right? So observe that from which they arise. But then, of course, we have these objective appearances, the discursive thoughts, the images, and so forth. And so let this be a systems type of awareness. That is, you're not just focused subjectively or just focused objectively, but really closely applying mindfulness to the mind, which includes mental consciousness, but also includes the Dharma Dhatu, that domain in which mental events take place. So let it be as a systems kind of mindfulness or awareness, such that when these more objective appearances arise, you observe them also. You're taking note of them, closely applying mindfulness to them. And if you can, observe that from which they arise. In other words, what the Buddha was calling the factors of origination. See if you can observe that from which they arise. Then they play themselves out. And don't worry if what's coming out is trivia, like an infomercial or just some mental junk. Likely it will be, you know. Probably not going to be, you know, quotes from the Buddha or Plato or Aristotle. It's probably going to be just ordinary junk, you know. But the content is not really what's of interest, but really as a scientist of the mind, not a historian or not a biographer. Oh, tell me, what's your story? Oh, what an interesting story you have. What's going on in your mind? Oh, you have such an interesting mind. Let's talk about your mind. That has its place. I'm not being, how do you say, sarcastic regard that. But it's a different deal. Here, we're just interested in what's the nature of mind, let alone your mind, his mind, her mind. But what's the nature of mind? What's the nature of thought? Let alone interesting thought, uninteresting thought. From what do they arise? Into what do they dissolve? Observe the cause of these causally originated thoughts and observe their cessation too. Observe that into which they dissolve. That's vipassana. That's really vipassana. That's really core. In a couple of years, if everything goes as imagined, who knows whether it will, but we'll have an 8-week retreat when we really spent 8 weeks really going into vipassana during the daytime and dream yoga at night, and we'll bring up this central theme. It's really central to Mahamudra and Dzogchen approach to vipassana, focus on the mind, and it's simply called Jungne Dosum. How does the mind emerge? How is it present? And how does it dissolve? Okay, really central. And that's, of course, all about realizing emptiness. The emptiness of your own mind. The emptiness of inherent nature of your own mind. It's really core, right? But for the time being, we're being a little bit more modest. We're going into the shallow end of the pool. If we can trace the origination of these subjective impulses, these emergences from the primary mind, the Semjung, these subjective impulses, if we can just trace them right back to mental consciousness, trace them right back to substrate consciousness, that would be something, right? And then similarly for the objective appearances, if we can observe what they're arising from and that into which they dissolve, for the time being we can call that Dharma Dhatu, the relative Dharma Dhatu, or when it's unconfigured, then of course they're arising from alaya, the substrate, and dissolving back into substrate. On a conventional level, relative level, that's a pretty big insight. Pretty big insight. So, let's jump in. Where do things come from? And where do they go? Okay. But first of all, let your awareness descend into the body. And as soon as it does so, as if your body were a snowman under the hot sun, as you let your awareness descend into and pervade the body, see if you can experience a type of melting, a dissolving, a loosening up, an unwinding. Wherever there's tension in the body, release it. Let it melt. settle your body in its natural state, relaxed, still, and vigilant. And then totally surrender all control over the breath. Let it settle in its natural rhythm. And for a short time, calm the discursive mind with mindfulness of breathing. Now let your eyes be at least partially open and evenly rest your awareness in the space in front of you without deliberately focusing on any object or subject. Don't meditate on anything. Don't focus your attention anywhere. Just be present. Without wavering, simply sustain the flow of mindfulness in the present moment, without distraction, without grasping onto anything. in that absence of grasping onto any sensory object, the absence of grasping onto any mental event, and the absence of grasping altogether, a type of knowing may dawn on you, like the moon coming out from behind the clouds. An unelaborated, already present knowing. And that is simply the knowing of being aware, the awareness of awareness. Rest in that knowing without elaboration, without extending your awareness anywhere else. As you rest in that nucleus, awareness resting in its own place, holding its own ground, knowing itself, note the mental events, the subjective mental processes that emerge from this flow of mental awareness. And if some subjective mental impulse arises, surges forth, don't impede it. Simply observe its manifestation. And observe its dissolution. When it fades away, watch that into which it fades. Into which it dissolves. Now let the light of your awareness, your mental awareness, illuminate single-pointedly, like a spotlight, the space of the mind, and whatever arises within that space. And as you attend closely from moment to moment, observe if you can the very process of emergence of discursive thoughts, of mental images. Observe that from which they arise. And as they vanish, observe that into which they vanish. Observe their causation and observe their cessation too. Now I know why you wear a cap. You might try a motorcycle helmet. It's a very rich area of inquiry, potentially very fruitful. As we gain clearer and clearer insight into how these subjective mental impulses arise, to which we generally identify so strongly, my emotions, my desires, my hopes, my fears, kind of almost define me, right? Let alone my thoughts, my imagination, my dreams, all of these things, and my own personal cinema, all the appearances arising in my mind, which we strongly identify. This is okay. I may lose a limb, I may lose this, but at least I have my thoughts. You know, at least I have my images, my mind. But when we carefully examine the manner in which both the subjective impulses as well as the objective appearances arise, then it becomes just more and more obvious. No one's doing it. There's just no evidence that there's anyone doing it, that there's any agent pulling the strings of the puppets. They're just happening. They're just happening. The Tibetan term is, you see them as chutsam. Chutsam. Simple, they're simply phenomena. They're simply phenomena with no additives. Not mind, not male, not female, not human. They're just phenomena, and they're just arising, and then you see how they're arising, and you see it's impersonal. That is, there was no subjective autonomous agent who made them happen who controls them. They're simply arising independent of causal conditions, and then their fuel is spent and they disappear like fireworks. They just whew, and then they just fade right back into the sky. And that's equally true for the appearances arising in the space of the mind as well as the subjective impulses, these mental states that emerge from the core mind, the principal mind, or fundamentally the substrate consciousness. So in that way, one can have direct insight into the anatta, the not-self nature of that which emerges from the stream of consciousness, that which emerges from the Dhamma Dhatu, or the space of the mind. But then also as you're just lingering there, just staying home, minding your own business, just being aware. And since there's nothing else to do, you're being aware of being aware, and that's kind of your full-time job. When you're just getting that very close, intimate encounter with just the experience of being aware, you see, that also has no personality. It's not old or young, it's not male, female, it's not human, it's just none of the above. It is simply what it is, and what it is transparent. It's luminous and it's cognizant. That is, it illuminates appearances and it knows. And that's it. There's really nothing more to say about it, but it's not a person. And if you say, yeah, but it belongs to me, exactly, good, where are you? Where are you, owner? I'm seeing all that you think you own, but what I don't see is you. Where is this owner? And then it's chutsam, it's simply a phenomenon, it's simply consciousness. It's not a person, an ego, a self, an I, it's simply what it is. It is consciousness. Just like space is space, earth is earth, and so forth. So in that way, there can be a real freedom, a looseness, a relaxation, a spaciousness around this. Not the tight, cramped corners of feeling you're caught inside your mind, like a very heavy person caught inside a telephone booth. You know, like, well, at least it's my booth. I can't even get my hand to my mouth, but at least it's my booth, you know? It's expansive, it's spacious. And you also then notice that it doesn't have any borders to it. That whole notion of borders is just like the border between, I don't know, this property and the adjacent property. Does anybody know where it is? I don't, but if you find out, it's only because somebody agreed it's so, you know? So it's just no borders, consciousness without borders. Just, there it is, open. And in that open space, awareness arising, mental events arising. So, not a bad prelude. Not a bad prelude to allowing your mind to dissolve into the substrate consciousness. So as it dissolves, you actually know what's dissolving. No mystery there. You've actually fathomed it. You see, conventionally speaking, you understand the nature of these mental emergences. You understand the nature of the thoughts, appearances, and so forth. You kind of get it. In other words, you become lucid with respect to the subjective impulses and the objective appearances. You're seeing them as they are on this relative or conventional level, so that when they dissolve, you say, okay, well, at least I figured you out before you left. You know? And where they're going to dissolve, finally, is at death, and that's where they're going to dissolve right into the same place that they're dissolving now. They're going to dissolve right into that substrate consciousness, and the appearances will dissolve right into the substrate. So if that's all you've gotten in a lifetime, is to understand the nature of the events that arise from that substrate and the substrate consciousness. And if you fathom the substrate consciousness and the substrate into which they dissolve, that's pretty significant. It's not liberation, it's not nirvana, it's not Buddha nature, but boy, it's better than yesterday's leftovers. That's really worth something. And if you've ascertained that, and then you're dying, and you're dying lucidly, and then you get dead, and you actually know, you say, yeah, I've been here before. You know, this is familiar, this is home, this is comfortable, this is okay, this is home, this is where all those things came from. If you really relax there, and knowing, maintaining lucidity, knowing substrate consciousness as substrate consciousness, you're not that far. So when the next episode begins, you know, one cinema has just come to an end, and now, what do they call it in the old days when they showed two movies back to back? Double feature, yeah. So the feature of, you know, this life's mind has come to an end, and then it goes dark. And he says, but it's a double feature. And out comes Rigpa. That's a pretty good show. And you're really quite poised to ascertain that. That would be very good. So, as a preparation for being able to venture into the teachings of Nagarjuna, the perfection of wisdom, the Madhyamaka middle way, this really makes it practical. Because my sense is that without this foundation in experience, going into your own mind, not your thoughts about your mind, not your thoughts about Madhyamaka reasoning about the mind, but actually going into the one mind that you can actually go into, and actually getting some experience, some insight there, practical, then with that basis of knowing the conventional nature of the mind, you say, yeah, I know what they're talking about. So the words are easy to say. Primary mind, mental events, luminous and cognizant nature, and so forth, easy to understand, and they're devoid of an inherently existent, autonomous, controlling self. Yeah, but I not only know how to parrot the words, but actually know what they're referring to. You know, to have that, to have, as Benjin Losen Shuki Gensen, the Benjin Rinpoche, Sutra of the Fifth Dalai Lama says, if you have now, through the practice of shamatha, you've ascertained semgi ngo, the essential nature of your mind, what that means is you actually know the nature of your mind. You know the nature of mind, not just your mind, his mind, her mind, but you actually know the nature of mind. You know, you've got one, and you've understood its nature, which means then you understand the nature of everybody else's minds. Not the unique qualities, of course, but if you've understood really one orange, then that pretty well takes care of oranges, right? And if you've got really fathomed one mind, well, that's good enough. Now you understand the nature of mind, right? But now when we, you know, when we leap ahead in this particular sequence, probably going to be 2 years from now, if, again, things go as imagined, who knows? But having 8 weeks or longer, eight lifetimes, whatever, to really do the ontological probe, really to try to realize the shunya nature, the emptiness of inherent nature of the mind. How exactly are you going to do that if you haven't ascertained the conventional nature? How are you going to just say, well, I don't really understand the nature of mind because all I've done is thought about it. But never mind that. I'm just going to go ahead and ascertain its ultimate nature. I don't quite see how that's possible. I don't really know. For example, if you don't know really what a kela is. You've heard about it. You've heard it described a little bit. But you don't really know what a kela is. They say, never mind. We're going to do an ultimate analysis now on the nature of Kela. It's not its form, it's not its shape, it's not its molecules, it's not its elementary particles, it's none of the above, it's not any individual component, it's not the collection of the components. You realize that, you realize the emptiness of Kela. It's going to be a bit thin, isn't it, if you don't know what a Kela is. She does. She does. He does. How you realize an empty nature of a banana if you don't know what a banana is? Right? I don't know how you could do that. It's just kind of more just words that you could get really good. Yeah, kela imbecher. I don't know what a kela is, but you know, imbecher. You know, you could debate and win debates and so forth and not know what the Sam Hill you're talking about. You just know how to do woo, yeehaw, korsum, yeehaw, yippee-yay-yay. So there it is. I think there's a lot to be said for actually understanding the conventional nature of the mind, and I don't know of any other better method than our shamatha methods, settling the mind, awareness of awareness, and then the close application of mindfulness to the mind. So it's pretty good. Namo to the Buddha. Hola, so we have a good deal of time now, so I'd like to go back and forth, read one, go back to you folks. With respect to the story you narrated about the illusionist, whose alaya does the illusion appear in? The audience's, the illusionist, or both? And that's from Elizabeth and Nicola. A team effort, hey? Yeah? I'm seeing a mind meld here. That's very good. Well, if the illusionist sees, let's say it's a man, the illusionist sees his own illusion, which certainly wouldn't be much fun if he couldn't, then Elizabeth, if the illusionist, using his substance, his mantra, and his samadhi, creates this illusion, an optical illusion, emerging from space, and he witnesses it, whose alaya is it appearing in when he witnesses it? Yeah. And Nicola, if there is an audience, then why would he do this if there's no audience? You know, he can just daydream. He can have his own illusions all by himself. But if he's going to go to all the trouble of having a substance, a mantra, and samadhi, and create an illusion for a public, and let's say you're the public, so it's an illusion, and he's creating it for you, and you see the illusion he just created, in whose alaya is the illusion that you're seeing appearing? Yours. That's right, and that's it. That's the answer. So thank you for answering your own question. Oh, I think so. I think so. You want to see me be an illusionist? I'm something very special. I've been pretending to be an ordinary person all along, but in fact, I'm about to show my powers. You ready? You ready? Okay. Om Mani Padme Hum. Do you see white? Oh, not bad, huh? I created the illusion of white in his alaya. Pretty cool. You want to see me do more tricks? I can do a lot more. How about fee, fi, fo, fum? Did you hear anything? Fee, fi, fo, fum. You did. I created another illusion in your alaya. The sound, because the sound you heard was appearing in your alaya. The sound that you heard when I said fee, fi, fo, fum. That's what the giants say. There is, too. But what I'm saying is, whether it's there is a difference. I'm glad you said, I can't fool you, can I? Shucks, I thought maybe you'd think I was a real illusionist. The simple point is, you know, by holding up a napkin, I can, you know, I'm doing something physical here. And I am holding up something, and lo and behold, you are seeing white arising in your alaya. And I contributed to that. If I had not done that, you would not have seen white there unless you saw the white of this. So there it is. Yeah. Good. All right. Take. Ah, you're not satisfied? Well, then I'm profoundly disappointed.
If you could produce the white from your alaya without that tissue in the middle, yeah, and he could see it, that would be different.
Yeah, and that's why you need an illusionist and not a guy holding up a napkin. part of this is mysterious. And that is, he's using something extraordinary here. This is contemplative technology. And that is, he's using an ordinary substance, according to, and I trust him completely, he's using an ordinary substance kind of as a platform, you know. I'm sure magicians have something that just, a coat is just a coat. But then he's got his mantra. This is the high-tech part. He's got his mantra and he's got his samadhi. And so instead of holding up a napkin, he's doing something with the, I would imagine, kind of the energetic power of the mantra. And then focused, it's almost, now I'm going to speak a little bit, how do you say, speculatively. Because, of course, I don't know how to do this. But reciting a mantra, any parrot can recite a mantra, right? But when that mantra, let's speak a little bit, just for fun here. Let's say the mantra is coming out, but instead of just going out like, psh, like that, like a mantra, om ahum, okay, there it goes, oh, like that, you know? But imagine that the mantra then is more like shut down a tube, like a laser. And what it's done is that mantra is captured in the laser beam of samadhi. So the samadhi is sharp, it's powerful. This is a natural force. It's electromagnetism, gravity, and so forth and so on. There are forces in nature, and consciousness is one of those forces, with the prana that goes with it. So let's just imagine speculatively that mantra is modifying the prana associated with the samadhi. The samadhi is very high energy, like a high frequency beam, right? It's samadhi. It's powerful stuff. And the energy, the prana associated with that samadhi, because consciousness is always associated with prana, that energy is being configured by the specific mantra. And mantras are all about vibration, right? So let's imagine that he's using his samadhi as like a tractor beam, and he's configured it with a particular mantra. He's got a target as a piece of wood, and he's drawing another person's mind into this to catalyze as a cooperative condition by power of my samadhi and the mantra, and then this trivial support, I'm going to catalyze that appearing in your mind. So the cooperative condition, that's why it said his samadhi and the mantra are cooperative conditions for generating the image, as is the mind of the observer, a cooperative condition. And where is the image occurring from? Space. Well, then it's whose space? Okay, your space, my space, her space, their space. But it's all individual spaces. But as when I'm holding up a piece of paper, you're all seeing white. You're all seeing white, right? Probably so. So even though what you're seeing is appearing in your substrate, and not in some generic substrate, somebody else's collective substrate, everybody's seeing it in your own substrate. Nevertheless, there is something here on a relative level that is objective, that is catalyzing, acting as a cooperative condition, for you to see something white rather than blue or nothing at all. Okay? Satisfied now? Sort of? Good. Then you get to reflect. Okay. Olaso. So that was written. Anything over here coming up? I will get more to more of these. Anything coming up here? Coming up here?
Can I follow up on?
We'll go to Chucho. We'll go to Chucho first.
Thank you. It's again about location of the mind, but from the perspective that Javana is happening is taking place in Dharmadhatu. Mm-hmm. Dharmadhatu,
yeah,
is where my awareness is.
That's right.
And so if I can locate my awareness, I can locate the space of the mind and its activities.
Quite so.
So when we say rest on the space of the mind and in your activity and the activities in there, are we given a guidance, a non-dual guidance, or is a conceptual guidance?
The conceptual guidance, since there are words being used, it's conceptual. If we can try this, if you like. I do have a pair of sandals out there. We could try something non-conceptual, if you like. You know, I could whack you with a sandal. I mean, that works for some people. But I think the percentage is so low that I don't try it. Another one that's not really conceptual, but it doesn't entail sound, and I'm going to mimic like a parrot, is peh. Okay. When you hear peh, when you're very well primed, you know, you're really ripe, you're ready, and an enlightened teacher, a person with clear realization of Rigpa, prepares you, and then peh gives you the pointing out instruction to Rigpa. The peh, that term, that syllable, doesn't have a referent. Like, oh, you mean that pit? You know, it doesn't refer to anything outside itself. It's more like a spike coming in. It's kind of like, you know, ice pick. You know what an ice pick is? Yeah, to break open ice. Kind of like an ice pick to break open your substrate consciousness, to shatter it and break through the substrate consciousness to Rigpa. Okay? So that would be a non-conceptual, because even though it's a sound, it's not really conceptual. Whereas if I say, the Buddha taught the causes of causally generated things. Okay. For Shariputra, that worked. And so it was conceptualization. It happens frequently. Tsongkhapa, when he was in retreat, you might recall, he was in retreat, a very accomplished yogi already, but he was reading a treatise, if I'm not mistaken. Andre is gone here, so my expert has vanished. But I think it was Buddhapalita. But in any case, he was reading some treatise on Madhyamaka. There he was. And he went into direct realization of emptiness. So it can be a text. It can be a teacher. Something conceptual. But the point here, in simple terms, is it starts conceptually, and the whole thing, it's the same old familiar theme. The finger pointing to the moon. The finger is the concept, and the moon is going beyond the concept to the referent. And that's substrate, rigpa, emptiness, what have you. Okay?
So it's a non-dual at the end.
That's certainly the idea. Sure. Because if it's really transcending concepts, then duality vanishes. Okay? Good.
Thank you.
Well, I assume let's read another one. Okay, this looks like more like some koans. Seeing things that aren't there. Smoke. But of course, smoke is there, so I don't understand yet. Suppressing things. It could well be, yeah. Why don't you decipher it for me?
Yeah, and it was the back one that you already answered. Actually.
Oh, okay, and this was just notes of your own.
Yeah.
Okay, jolly good. No wonder I couldn't understand it. Very good, thank you. Good, good. How can we make more lucid our implicit knowing? What do you suggest we can try to do in our meditations or even in daily life? And this is from Sandra. There's Sandra. Shamatha and Vipassana and Dzogchen. Yeah. But we start from something where we can get some traction. Like if you're in a car and you're trying to drive up a steep hill, you can drive up the steep hill if and only if your tires get some real traction. They can dig into, they can hold the soil. If they're in just mud, then we all know what happens. The tires just spin, right? It's very easy, frankly, for the mind to simply spin when we go into Madhyamaka reasoning. Or go into teachings on Dzogchen, you know? And the mind is going around and around, and this is really fascinating, it sounds really profound, and wow, that's really cool, and wow, he's really brilliant. And then we go home, and you're looking exactly how far up the mountain did you go in terms of purifying your mind, your mental reflection is decreasing, genuine happiness arising, genuine unhappiness vanishing, and direct insight into reality taking place. So getting traction is a big deal. And I think often that's maybe overlooked a little bit, you know, in teachings on Vajrayana, in teachings on Dzogchen, Mahamudra. I'm reminded a little bit of the Discovery Channel, one of the cable networks, and there are other ones like that. There's some very good documentaries, and there's some outstanding scientists, people like Brian Greene. He's a very good scientist, very good physicist. He's also very articulate, very clear. He'll talk about string theory. He'll talk about the Big Bang. And we have other very fine scientists who are excellent scientists, and they're very articulate, you know. ANOVA is all about that. So they generally have very high-quality scientists who also can articulate well, and they'll talk about a wide range of very fascinating things. So how would you like to get a PhD in astrophysics by watching NOVA for a year? You know, or anything. So a lot of the teachings that are given without the context, without the foundation, without really formal sustained meditative training to provide some foundation for it, it's more like watching NOVA. It's interesting. And you're getting it from a fine teacher who may really know what he or she is talking about. So I think you can see I'm not denigrating anything here. Not NOVA, not the Discovery Channel. They have some very fine scientists giving very good presentations. And is that how you get a PhD in physics or genetics or neuroscience? By watching really good scientists giving one hour or one half hour clips on, you know, with some really nice visual displays. It's just no, right? No. For that, you just have to put in some hard work. And I know from physics, from the very first term, we're running experiments. We're studying it academically. We're studying the text. We're learning the mathematics and all of that. But from the very beginning, we're running our own experiments. And we're seeing how well we can run the experiment. We're measuring the data, calculating the data. We're doing the work. And the same thing was true for mathematics. And that is, I had some really good instructors in mathematics. Amherst is an outstanding college. And I was told this, it's so true. And I studied the history and philosophy of mathematics also. And there's just something about mathematics. The only way you ever learn mathematics is by doing it. You can read all the books on history of mathematics, read book about mathematics, you can watch NOVA programs on mathematics. And the only way you'll ever learn mathematics is just by doing the problems. There's just no shortcut, right? And the same is true of meditation. One can be a neuroscientist and be studying other people doing meditation until the cows come home, which means indefinitely. And you can know about all the neurocorrelates of meditation. And you can study the techniques so you can write about them in your articles. When all is said and done, you don't have a clue of what it actually is to meditate. You know, it's like reading recipes, and you don't know the taste of any of the food that's described in the menus. So, in this regard then, really developing some foundation. So, shamatha, for your question, it's a very good question. Because here's the capacity, and we know in modern psychology, in which I'm no expert, I think you actually have a degree, don't you, in psychology? Yeah, and I don't. So you know more about that than I do. But my sense is, because I work a lot with psychologists now for more than 20 years, is that if you raise in a professional psychological setting, if you raise, well, now let's turn our attention to intuition. What is its nature? How does it arise? What is its depth? What is the degree of accuracy of intuition? How do you develop intuition? I think that's going to be a very short conversation. Right? Am I right? Yeah. It's a term that we all know about, and I think we'd find it in multiple European languages, intuition. And yet it remains soft and fuzzy. Soft and fuzzy. And when you say intuition, what do you mean, a hunch? Or do you mean a guess? Or are you talking about extrasensory perception? Are you talking about, what are you talking about? And what is it, after all? And so, let's define it. And let's set it apart from a hunch, a guess, speculation. Let's imagine that it exists, and then we can define it. And then if it doesn't exist, once we've defined it, then we should get a clearer sense of whether it does or doesn't exist. So let's define it. Intuition is a way of knowing. In other words, not just a hunch or a guess, but it's a way of knowing. It does not come by way of the five physical senses. And it does not come by way of reasoning and inference. But it is a knowing. Okay? And now if we want to, and that would be pretty good because in Western psychology, you know, they don't even talk about mental perception. But now we don't have to limit ourselves to those kind of particular blinkers. Say, okay, well, we have six modes of perception. So now let's simply include that we have six modes of perception, including I'm directly observing my dreams, and that's most obvious when you're having a lucid one, because it's not by inference, you're not simply remembering dreams of times past, you're seeing something right now, you're seeing it with not any of the five physical senses, you are directly perceiving it, therefore, mental perception, what else is going to be, right? And so, but now we can say, oh, intuition, okay. Intuition is a way of knowing that is something beyond, something out of the ordinary, something anomalous that is mental, so it's not a visual intuition, auditory, it's mental, but it's something subtler, something less obvious than simply observing your thoughts. And it has a kind of confidence to it. When it arises, one has a sense that there's more than merely a guess. Okay? Is that an okay definition? Okay definition. So, let's imagine that there is such a mode of knowing. then how would we develop it? Having defined it. I'm not saying that's the right definition. I'm just saying, okay, well, let's try this one on for size. Okay? Because after all, human beings decide what definitions are correct and what are not correct. So I'm just presenting that one. So let's imagine there is this kind of immediate knowing that is mental, that something subtler, something more profound, something perhaps less local than simply observing the thoughts arising in your own mind. Right? Then how could we cultivate that? Now that we've defined it, maybe that already gives some pointers, some indicators, some suggestions of how you might develop that, refine it, and then also be able to distinguish intuition from mere guesses and speculations, which of course we can conflate the two, or hopes, anticipations, and so forth, wishful thinking. And so how might one go about doing that? And the way I would do it would be to say, all right, let's cut out the competition. That is, there are other ways that we know. That is, I know by thinking hard and analytically and cogitatively and inferentially. I know about that, and that's not inference. That's not inference, or that's not intuition. So let's set that one aside. That has its value, but we're not talking about that, right? And then we have the five sensory modes, and we're not talking about that, and so let's withdraw from that also, because we don't want to be derailed, be distracted by, oh, I can hear sounds, I can see colors. That's not intuition, okay? And so, okay, but it's mental. And now, within the mental, let's see if we can make this subtler and subtler and subtler and go beyond the obvious. Let's see if we can sharpen it. There's a nice metaphor, and that is, if ordinary mental consciousness, ordinary mental perception, is kind of like low frequency, which means not very powerful, how about bringing it to a higher frequency? Higher frequency. Which means more powerful, more energetic. It could be used for Star Wars. A high-energy laser can be used as a weapon, for example. Or as a flashlight, no. And so, if we could intensify, heighten the frequency, heighten the acuity, the high definition, the resolution, the sharpness of mental perception, and see beyond the obvious, might that not be a way to tap into and to sustain and then clarify this more subtle way of knowing that we call intuition, and then turn that into a science. So this relates then to a point made by one of the most brilliant minds in the whole history of Indian Buddhism. He was very famous for his brilliance, for his goodness, and for his contemplative mastery. And that was Atisha. Atisha. And I've quoted him before, and I'll quote it again because it's relevant to your question, and that is that unless you have extrasensory perception, you really can't help the world. You really can't be of much benefit. Okay? And since I said, hey, by the way, this is not a foolish man talking, this is Atisha talking, then we should, because that has to be taken seriously. He's still talked about and revered 1,000 years later. Not too many people can you say that of. That people still respect him, and they see his readings, and they're still deeply impressed by his readings 1,000 years later. There's probably something really going on there. Atisha was definitely of that caliber. So he said this, so what's he referring to? Of course, hedonically, can we help other people even if we don't have extrasensory perception? It's a question that doesn't need to be asked. Of course we can. Doctors, nurses, teachers, hardware salesmen, and so forth. There's a myriad of ways to be of service, including be a salesperson. Nothing wrong with that. It's the right livelihood. If it's done honestly. So hedonically, of course, we don't need that. But if, since this statement by Atisha was in the context of bodhipada pradiptam, lamp for the path to enlightenment, that's the context. Well, then we know this was not about dentistry or about, you know, other things, learning archery. That this is what the whole text was about is, who can help us here? Following a path. And a path means something you don't fall back. That it's really evolution. But it's not just evolution adapting to this, that, and the other thing. It's an evolution in the sense of a maturation, a transformation, a purification, and something is irreversible. It's a true path. So that if you've gained profound realization in one lifetime, but you're not yet finished, you're not yet a Buddha or an arhat, but something really genuine. And you've actually entered the path and not just had some really good Tummo experience or some nice Po experience or some Sage Generation experience or some Six Yogana experience or Dzogchen experience or Mahamudra experience or Lamrim experience. There's all kinds of very meaningful experiences. But not only have you had a lot of very meaningful experiences, but you actually entered the path. You know, if you have, if that's the case, you've entered the path and done so irreversibly, then in your next lifetime, you're still on the path. Otherwise, you weren't on the path in the first place. You're still on the path. And whether it's a million lifetimes to come, or whether it's two, or whether you're going to be achieving full enlightenment in the very next lifetime, you're in a path every single lifetime. And no one outside can stop you. They can treat you horribly. They can give you no Dharma teaching. They can give you Dharma teaching, give you terrible Dharma teaching. They can make you milk cows for the rest of your life. But they can't kick you off the path. You're actually on the path. It's an inside job. And nobody outside can take that away from you. That's a person who's actually achieved the path. So, a teacher speaking in that context, if you want to help people achieve a path and not just teach them Dharma, then you really need to have extrasensory perception. It's like telling a person, if you'd like to become an internist, number one, you have to learn a lot. But also, you need to learn about blood tests and x-rays and stethoscopes, and you need to learn about all the technology that's used to really get the inside picture of what's going on in the bodies of your patients. You can't just look at them and ask them to talk. You probably won't be able to heal them that way. You'll need to have, you know, this inside, the extrasensory perception of the blood tests, of x-rays, of stethoscope, and the myriad of other type of tests that medical doctors do. And that's their kind of technological extrasensory perception. Because after all, we don't have x-ray eyes, but happily with technology, well, we have x-ray eyes, right? And so a professor of medicine might say, unless you have the technology, unless you have a good lab, unless you have these instruments to really know what's going on inside your patients' bodies, you really can't help them. Where would you go if you need to perform a surgery? Exactly where would you cut? You know, unless you know already where you're going. Cut here, because this is where the problem is. So in a similar fashion, is with paranormal extrasensory perception, that you actually know the minds of the people you're seeking to help. You have x-ray vision. That's one of the extrasensory perceptions. There's others as well. So this is a teacher. He's raising the bar very high. But he's raising the bar for marga, not just for being a Dharma teacher or help people get over, you know, some psychological distress. It's very valuable. Very valuable. It's a very important role for psychotherapists. Respect. But that's not marga. That's not path. So he's saying, if you want to be truly effective in helping others achieve marga, you must have extrasensory perception, which is then intuition. Intuition in a whole bandwidth of intuition. Because there's remote viewing, that's the type of intuition. There's knowing other people's minds, that's an intuition. There's knowing your own and other people's past lives, that's an intuition. Because it's not something you just obviously see with your mental perception. You certainly don't see it with instruments of technology or your five physical senses, but you do get it, that's intuition. So that's extrasensory perception. That would be really helpful to know the history of your patient. And that is knowing the causes of causally produced things. And knowing that for the particular types of distress that your patient, the Dharma student, is experiencing, not all of those causes are necessarily, and that is, not all of those causes are located in this life alone. There can be deep roots. And the more thoroughly, more clearly, fully, the teacher can see the short and the long-term causes giving rise to the distress now, the particular array of mental afflictions that need healing, then the more effective that person will be. Right? So all of this about intuition. And then he says, if you don't have shamatha, you can't develop extrasensory perception. Therefore, develop shamatha. That's what he says. Yeah. So that's why, that's my answer. If you develop shamatha and then vipassana, on top of that, the fusion of shamatha and vipassana, you get much deeper intuition, much deeper. Right? And then if you break through your substrate consciousness, your relative level of consciousness, You break through that to Rigpa. Then you tap into a much, much deeper level of intuition, and that's called primordial consciousness, which is non-local and atemporal. And now you've tapped into the wellspring of all intuition, the mother of all the Buddhas. Okay? That's the answer. Good. Oh, yeah. Nicola, what's up? Is it still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. No, but it was about the question that we were talking about. I was just
Footnote, go ahead.
So just to clarify, what gave rise to this question is that one of the things that the substantial cause for that illusion is alaya, the space.
It is the substantial cause, yes.
Right. Yeah. So where we were going with it is if then the illusionist has the power to create
cooperatively condition.
So
to catalyze, to trigger.
Okay. Yeah. So, like from my side, no point.
I'm saying this because I try to use words very carefully. And when you say create, it sounds like he's getting his hand into your mind and doing something there. And that's not the case. What he's doing is creating cooperative conditions to catalyze the emergence of that image, that appearance in your alaya.
In my mind.
It's a softer touch. It's a catalyst rather than getting in there and actually making it.
And the way he draws that is by drawing the attention, meaning drawing the audience's attention, he draws their substantive cause for that illusion in their own minds. Right?
Yeah, he's conditioning that space. Because again, where would you see the illusion? Here, there, up, down? He has to give it, maybe that's what that physical substance is about, to give it a location. But it's not going to appear any old. It's going to appear where he wants it to appear. And so he's then conditioning the space, acting as cooperative condition for the space, that it's going to appear here and not there.
Mm-hmm.
He's also serving as a cooperative condition to condition the minds of the observers so they can see it. And he's doing that with this fusion of the mantra and his samadhi. Okay? Okie dokie. Good. And I think we do have time for one more. It's a juicy one. So, in the spring retreat, I spoke of taking refuge, developing, and or developing authentic bodhicitta as two steps which would greatly benefit one's meditation. My understanding of these two things is very limited. Could you explain and emphasize what implications this has for one's daily life? And I'll read more. So, and for those of you who train in Mahayana Buddhism, many of you are, you know that's really how you'll start kind of virtually any formal practice. Refuge from the three jewels, maybe the three jewels and your lama, and then developing bodhicitta, and then you carry on into the main practice. So it's very standard practice. Can taking refuge and developing authentic bodhicitta be done on various levels? There I can give a short answer. Absolutely, yes. There are multiple levels to both. In fact, why don't I just jump in right there? This is from Andreas. And so ultimate level, why don't we just go to the end of the show, because there are multiple levels for sure. But ultimate level of taking refuge is taking refuge in your own rigpa with no outer display. Oh, to you, oh, I take refuge in you. Because that is a display of your own rigpa. So the end game, the culmination, the end point of taking refuge is, it's not just, okay, I'll be self-reliant, I'll rely on my own judgment. Because when I'm taking refuge in there, it's just my coarse mind with all my mental afflictions and intelligence, but all the garbage with it. So it's a very wobbly refuge. If I just say, well, I'm a smart guy, I have a PhD, I'll take refuge in myself. Well, okay, but that's not rigpa, right? And so, but when you've identified rigpa, then you've recognized this is my ultimate refuge. Well, you'll notice that I love to go back and forth. I often skip so many stages in between, but I love citing the Pali Canon, which is where I began today. This, to my mind, really beautiful story of Shariputra in this ever so simple little phrase. The causes of causally conditioned things, the Buddha has shown their causes, and their cessation too. That there it is, and then the end of that story is Shariputra, and the phrase that was associated with it when it comes to the end of his life was, be an island unto yourself, take refuge in the Dharma. That sounds so Dzogchen. It's absolutely core, fundamental, foundational, initial Buddha Dharma. You know? Take no external refuge. Be an island of yourself. Your refuge is Dharma. So there's all kinds of stages in between. Many, many, the five paths, the ten bhumis, and Mahayana, Hinayana, Vajrayana, Dzogchen, the nine yanas, three yanas, or any yana you like. And we're just starting at the basic, then looking, there's the beginning, here's the end. So similar. Okay, so there's refuge. And then likewise with bodhicitta, there's conventional bodhicitta, really arousing this benevolent aspiration for all sentient beings, the wish to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all without exception. And what's the ultimate nature of bodhicitta? That's relative nature. Ultimate nature of bodhicitta, the ultimate bodhicitta, is rikpa. It's rikpa. Rikpa knowing itself. Could it be an idea to take refuge for a limited period of time, for example, for the duration of a retreat, to get a sense of what it means? I'll go there first. These are all good questions, and these ones I can give a bit shorter response to, and I think it's just enough time to cover this, and then we'll have dinner. Sure. But I'd want to contextualize it with the assertion that taking refuge is not something that we might do one day if we're so religiously inclined, or we're feeling really spiritual, or we develop a strong aspiration for liberation or enlightenment. Taking refuge is something we've been doing ever since birth. Ever since birth. Newborn babies taking refuge in mama. Or whoever's there. Maybe it's a nanny. Maybe mama died in childbirth and it's dad. Who knows? Maybe it's a stranger. Maybe it's an orphanage. But taking refuge means entrusting yourself. Right? And entrusting yourself to something that's beyond your knowledge. Does so the baby know the full capacity of the mother to take care of the child? The answer is no way. But the baby has not much choice, so the baby relies upon, places trust in the mother. When we're getting education through elementary school, and your teachers, your science teachers, your spelling teachers, history teachers, and so forth, how do you know that they're not just lying to you? Teaching you a language that no one speaks. You don't. The answer is you don't. There are a bunch of adults, all these tall people. And they all seem to know what's going on. Okay, tell me, what's the history of our country? We were born from an alligator egg? Okay. How long ago? You know, what do we know? So to get an education, you're taking refuge in your teachers. You get a toothache. Are you really going to study dentistry long enough so that you can check to see whether the dentist is fully capable because you could do exactly what he could do? In which case, who needs a dentist? Yeah. Just stick the drill in your own mouth. And so we take refuge in our dentists, we take refuge in our doctors, we take refuge in psychotherapists, in our accountants, and so many other things. The airline industry. Do you really know how those doggone things fly? I have to say, I really don't. I get into one of those 747s, and I know my gut instinct is this will not get off the ground. I just know it's so doggone heavy. And those little wimpy little wings, give me a break. It's not going to get off the ground. Somehow it does. And I just trust when I see the wings flapping that they're not going to break off. And I don't know whether they will or not, but I just take refuge in, you know, Boeing. So in other words, the simple point is we're doing this all the time. So refuge in the Buddha Dhamma is one of many types of refuge. If one is checking out a teacher, checking out a checking out a tradition, Mahayana Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, the Ashtanga Yoga, the Yoga tradition, Christianity, what have you, wherever there's something that suggests here's a path of transformation, something for which you can really derive benefit, then it makes very good sense, you're suggesting. Go in with an open mind. Go in with an open mind. As Aryadeva says, go in with a perceptive mind, a mind that is open-minded, and a mind with a real yearning to practice. So if you're simply going as a spectator, out of sheer curiosity, you can, but you'll really never figure out what's going on because you're not venturing into it. So to have enough trust that when the teacher, let's say a person like Goenka, says, all right, now sit here for 4 days, 11 hours a day, and watch your breath. Okay. Okay, I'll try it. And then he says, okay, now for the 6 days, for 11 hours a day, I want you to scan through your body. Go scan, scan, scan. Okay. So for 10 days, this is a good man. He has a good heart. He's helped tens of thousands of people. And many, many, many of them, I think the great majority of them, take his 10-day course, and they found it really beneficial. Will it be beneficial for you or not? You don't know. But he's not a charlatan. He's not an exploiter. There's just no question about that. Is he in it for the money? No way. Very pure. Very pure. In that regard, really true. Truly pure. And so give it a shot. Give it your best shot. So for 10 days, let Goenka be your teacher. And see, I'm giving it my best shot. I'm putting my trust in this. A lot of people have got benefit. My friends told me about this. She got a lot of benefit. I'll try it. For 10 days, I'll give it my trust. And I'll see, give it my best shot to see whether I can get benefit from it or not. And that doesn't mean I'm going to believe everything he says. And he doesn't ask for that. But I'll listen closely. If he says some things that I simply can't accept, as he says, and he gives, I remember it because I took his course back in 74. If he says, if you hear some things that you can't accept, then just set it aside. And he gives a nice example. I remember this from 1974. He said, if somebody, I think he was talking about some rice, if somebody cooks you up a nice little bowl of rice and it has some cardamom in it, and you give it to someone, like a child, and the child says, I wanted rice. I didn't want green rocks in my rice. I don't like green rocks. He said, no, it's not green rocks. It's cardamom. It's very tasty. No, no, it's a green rock. I don't like green rocks. I don't like it. Okay, take them out. Take them out. That's nice. It's very sweet. Cardamom's very sweet, so is the story. But if you see something and says, I can't accept that. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me, or I just don't believe that, or I don't want to deal with that. Good, take it out. Say, I'll set that aside. Maybe I'll munch it later, maybe not. But for the time being, look at what you can engage with, practice, reflect upon, try to derive benefit from. And that's what he suggests. I think it's very wise, very good teaching. Get what you can. And if some of the stuff you just find useless or maybe disagreeable, set it aside and get what you can. It's your life. So that would be taking refuge. And then at the end of the 10-day course, then you can see, is that something you want to continue? Do I want to go deeper on this path? Or do I say, I think I got as much as from that as I want to for the time being, and now I'm going to keep moving on? So the short answer is yes, definitely. For an 8-week course, a lot of you people never met me before, so I'm here to offer my best. But sometimes, just personality to personality just doesn't work out that well. That's not a problem. Then find another teacher. Sometimes it's a teaching, just not the kind of teaching that I really resonate with. Not a problem. Find another teaching. Or maybe just Buddhism, just those Four Noble Truths, they just don't do it for me. Okay? Find another path. But for 8 weeks, at least you will have known what was being offered in 8 weeks. And so you've made an informed choice. I like the teacher, the teaching, but that teacher's not really quite my cup of tea. I like the general tradition, but I don't really care for this approach. Or I do engage well with the teacher, and whatever it is. But whatever, you'll know, because you've given it your best shot. And you've given it your trust, that at the very least, one thing is, if you have the sense that the teacher is there with anything other than the motivation to be of service, I say head for the door immediately. There was a statement I just heard, it was very forcefully said, it was beautifully said. It was from Dingo Kensu Rinpoche. Dingo Kensu Rinpoche. In some, I don't know which book, but somebody just told me, maybe it was one of you, it might have been Andrea, that told me that if you are a Dharma teacher and you're teaching out of a motivation other than kindness, you're not worth the space you're taking up. I like that. So if you have a teacher that you feel this person's in it for something else, in other words, it's an I-it relationship and I'm the it, there's the door and get out. It doesn't matter how clever, charismatic, blah, blah, blah the teacher is. It's not from that conduit, not from that one. Get the same teaching. Get it from somebody else. True? So there's that. To which extent? Oh, now I have to be quick. To which extent is there a danger of taking such steps too early without fully understanding the implications, thus getting into a state of confusion and doubt, or simply doing it as a superficial act without much meaning? That certainly is a danger. almost like going prematurely into a marriage. You know, just kind of an infatuation. Oh, yeah, I'll be with you forever, except for a week later. I don't think so. So that can be that way. Or one can trust in a business venture. You may trust too soon. And say, oh, my goodness, what did I get myself into? So as in a business partnership, a marriage, and so forth and so on, one goes with eyes open. Goes with eyes open. I mean, it's just good common sense. But sometimes common sense isn't there. One is so taken, impressed by the charisma or the apparent kindness, maybe it's genuine kindness, or whatever of the teacher of the teaching, that one plunges in and then finds, whoa, I think I've got myself into something I don't really want to follow. So the question, I'll finish this off. What could be the consequences if such steps are coming out of fear and self-centeredness as the primary motivation? Have you observed any of these scenarios? Yeah, I have. I think I've seen a wide variety, because I've been watching this for a long time. And do people sometimes take refuge out of fear and self-centeredness? The answer is yes, no question. And it often winds up being a very wobbly kind of thing. Because if it's fear, then if you're just so fearful, then you could have taken refuge in anything, frankly, because you're fearing from something. But unless you're really taking refuge in something, then why you go here instead of there? So I read the question yesterday, about to wrap up here. But I think sometimes people will ostensibly or go through the appearance of taking refuge with simple blind faith or something also really, how do you say, not well-informed. Wanting to be part of a group, the sense of belonging, just impressed by somebody's charisma or outer displays, or maybe one likes their temples or likes their liturgies and so forth. So it may be quite superficial, and that tends to be quite fragile. So it can be that. Sometimes one may be approaching it primarily with one's intelligence. And if one encounters really intelligent teaching, that you apply your intelligence to it, and it just stands up, and you say, wow, this is really smart, then one might take refuge with one's intelligence in something one finds very intelligent. One may do so out of a very deep devotional sense. This happens in multiple traditions all over the world, where one by disposition is a very devotional person, and one meets a person that one feels this person is so profoundly good, and maybe actually is, that out of just sheer devotion, I take refuge in it. Now, what was it? What are you teaching again? You know, because you're really taking refuge in the person, and then you're waiting. Well, tell me what's true, because I'm ready to receive whatever comes out of your lips. That'll be truth for me, because I've already taken refuge in you. That's taking refuge in the individual. Whereas the classic Buddhist approach is most centrally take refuge in the Dharma. Because the teacher is the revealer of the Dharma. Your fellow Sangha, the congregation, your fellow practitioners, they're your aids. But the true refuge is the Dharma. And I'll give two more. Because I think it's a very interesting question, it's very nuanced, has multiple levels, and I could go on a lot longer, but I won't. And that is sometimes intuition. I've seen this in case many, many cases. In fact, in some sense, it was me too, to some extent, not fully. But to some extent, it definitely was. Intuition, how about that? Where you hear some teachings, or you read a book, and without really understanding intellectually, that is, it's not really compelling, you know, wow, that was incredibly smart, and you don't have the experience, but just something like, some reverberation deep, deep in your core just says, yes, there's something here. And my answer is yes. And now I just want to explore more. Doesn't mean I'm going to go proceed with blind faith. It's just this hooked me at such a deep level that the answer is yes. Right. It can be a case of just feeling, this is home. And I was never able to articulate it. But if I could have, it would have been something along those lines. And now I want to know, tell me more about home. And when I picked up my first book on Tibetan Buddhism, it was about something I understood almost nothing of. It was the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation, about Dzogchen. That was my first book on Tibetan Buddhism. And I read through it cover to cover, and I understood almost nothing. I just knew this is going to be it. And he said, yeah, you're a smart guy, you're educated, so tell me your reasons. I said, I don't know. I just know this is where I'm going. Intuition. It's not blind faith. And it wasn't even Padmasambhava, oh, what a great being. It was teaching from him. I didn't really know who Padmasambhava was, but it was the teaching. There's something there. And then finally, and this will be the point I knock off on, and that is sheer experience. Just experience. And that is, I'm not taking refuge, but I'm going to give it a shot. The teachings make sense, the practice makes sense, and I'm going to put the practices into practice and see for myself through my own experience. So not intuition, putting into practice. Does my mind become relaxed, stable, and clear? Am I getting insights? Are my mental afflictions getting less? Is my genuine unhappiness, is that subsiding? Is this helping or is it not? And then seeing through your own experience, boy, this teaching is authentic. The practices are good. I can trust this. And then you go deeper, deeper, deeper. And the trust gets deeper and deeper and deeper. It gets irreversible. So the final note is this. I've seen this in the Pali Canon. Really, when I first saw it, I said, whoa, that's interesting. And it was, well, actually, I've already cited two cases, but I didn't elaborate on it. But I remember one case in particular, but there are many of this in the Pali Canon, where someone comes to the Buddha and requests teachings. The Buddha gives the teachings. At the end of the teaching, the person has become stream enterer, gained direct realization of nirvana, is now irreversibly on a path, and having already achieved stream entry, then takes refuge in the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha. Not before. That is absolutely experience-based. You've just shown me the truth. You've just liberated my mind. Therefore, I know you're a good doctor. And it's because I know it from my own experience. You gave me teachings. They liberated my mind. Thank you. Now I know I can trust you. Give me the rest of the package, please. I want to become an arhat. You know? So that's another way. Straight experience. Okay? So I've gouged deeply into your dinner time. But good questions all. Whether the answers were worthy, that's for you to decide. Enjoy your evening.